Hi, thank you for listening to the Spotlight Report, our weekly podcast in which we sit down and speak with current academics about their life and research in lab. If you like the Spotlight Report, you can subscribe on iTunes, like our Facebook page, or find it on any common podcast app. You can also directly find the podcast on our website, which is loft.optics.arizona.edu/podcast. Please comment any questions or ideas for people you would like us to interview in the future. Additionally, if you have more feedback, feel free to email us at thespotlightreport@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. This week on the Spotlight Report, we are going to be speaking with Dr. Koshal. He is the Associate Dean of Optics and has a very robust background both in industry and academics. His CV is almost a book in itself, I would say. So we're very excited to talk to him. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Koshal.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Just to start off with, could you comment on what made you decide to go into optics?
That is not too hard. My father, he's a nuke physicist, PhD, worked at a university. He said, why don't you do this optics thing? And I'm not sure. And that was at Rochester. So I went to Rochester and I started taking classes. And that time the classes were about 80 in each undergraduate class. So they were huge classes, and then in my sophomore year, I knew I had embarked on the right field because, and this is going to annoy some people or show that I'm a nerd, during an exam, I thought the professor had asked the most excellent question ever developed, and I looked up at the professor and just said, that was a great question. You know, he didn't hear me, of course. And then, of course, you don't tell your friends that
right
during the exam because they didn't get the question, maybe. So, and it was on Fresnel diffraction with the Cornu spiral, so that he set the slits so that they were varying distances and sizes or something like that, and so that you were always at the exterior of the Cornu spiral every time you added a new slit.
Huh.
So that they added better.
Right, right.
Than if you would just put them in a regular break. So then I knew I had chosen the right field.
Okay. And just based on the fact that you enjoyed it at that point, you figured might as well pursue graduate work?
Yeah, I always knew I was going to go into graduate school because I liked my father's lifestyle. I didn't know all the other things that went into it, but he was able to do a little of what he wanted, and he could be there at other times.
Right, right.
And so I thought that's a pretty good job. I didn't know what it fully entailed until probably I got into maybe towards the end of my undergraduate and then graduate school, what it meant to be a professor.
Right. I think you knew earlier and better than I did then, because it's taken me a little ways into grad school to fully comprehend what being in grad school involves. But
it's okay. You nailed it down. So,
yeah, it took me a little bit of time. So was it in graduate school that you decided to focus on illumination or radiometry?
No.
Okay.
During graduate school, I was in Ian Walmsley's group at Rochester, and he was doing ultra short pulse development and measurement. I was on the laser development side, so I was designing pump cavities for lasers, and that employed non-imaging optics for those pump cavities. So that's how I got into that. So I started graduate school really doing laser development, high-power, ultra-short pulse lasers.
So why the shift to illumination?
I didn't like lasers as much as I thought I would like.
See, that's a good reason.
I enjoyed more the optical engineering and the ray tracing.
So huh.
I enjoyed that aspect of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So do you mind telling us what is your current research about?
Well, it's illumination broadly. The group, we just sort of pseudo-finished a project for the illumination for a painting over at the Art Museum. So we have a prototype. I'm hoping to get that the prototype that was manufactured outside of here. Mm. It's a freeform optic for really oblique illumination. And to put it in over at the art museum here on campus for the illumination of one of their paintings. That was a prototype, so it was not done yet. But that was purely a voluntary project. But that led to a couple theses, Caitlin Williams for how do you characterize freeform optics, and then Rachel for how do you characterize the illumination that paintings are getting, because they have a standard, it's called the blue wool standard, and they look at just blue wool samples and how they degrade under lighting. And it's not a very objective standard, it's very subjective. You look when you see color, and at that time you've already damaged the painting. That painting is that we're illuminating is Mark Rothko's Green on Blue, and it's worth the whole College of Optical Sciences. So why wouldn't you illuminate it well?
Right.
So she worked on a standard that would do a cell phone spectrometer to replicate what the blue wool standard would be measuring over its lifetime. And so that led to those two projects. And then I have a current PhD student, and she's studying including tolerances in the freeform optics design and optimization. And also she's doing a little study right now on light pipe design and metrics. And then I have a funded project, and it's into the imaging arena, and it's on extended depth of field. Are there any new technologies that can be employed in that area? And currently we're looking at some interferometric methods to do that.
I remember being present for Rachel's defense for her thesis. It's really exciting. It's always fun to get to see how you can take optics like and just apply it in a really quick and easy way. Yeah, you guys applied it on the cell phone, but it just seemed like super useful for the people that are going to be in the art museums or making these measurements.
That was the whole thing. They won't accept technology that they can't understand. They won't understand the technology in there, but they understand.
It's a cell phone. Right.
And the cell phone is getting an increasing amount of use, like in your group.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's one student that's been using it. There are other people designing optics for cell phones in this in the college here, so
yeah,
I think it's ripe for a lot of development.
Yeah, and I know in the medical arena, there's a big push to do rapid diagnoses using a cell phone. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I'd like to take a step back, and I don't know of anyone more qualified. Can you just describe broadly what is illumination for people who's that's not their focus?
Simply getting light from the source to the target without the imaging constraint.
Okay.
You can have the imaging there, but you don't need it.
Okay.
So that's source to target or source to object. Don't have to necessarily image.
Okay, perfect.
Good.
So you worked in industry for quite some time. Can you comment on the difference between the industry environment versus academic environment?
They're pretty similar, actually, the industry I've been in. The biggest difference, and I can talk from the design, the optical engineering side, and I can relate this to my dissertation. Well, basically, what I did in my dissertation probably would have taken 3 or 4 months if I was in an industry. And so I tell everyone that what you're doing for your dissertation is 3 or 4 months in industry. Sure, in industry, you know most everything, but you're provided usually better resources because you're working in a given company that's trying to do something and sell something. So you have those resources, they're paying you to do that, and you're not learning while doing. You already have most of that knowledge in your head.
Right.
Okay, so yes, you're developing new technologies, so you're not as resource limited, and that's probably not true in every group, but And also in academia, you're probably pushing the envelope a little more. You're learning as you're doing, even for the people who are the established professors. You're really pushing the technology a bit further than the industry would.
Right.
Okay. So overall, I'd say it's pretty similar, at least in my experiences. You would think maybe the red tape would go away. No, it's there everywhere.
Okay.
So, does this experience add something on your view to the optics? Or it always remains the same for your point of view of what is optics in your head?
Has my experience changed what I thought optics was?
Mm-hmm.
Is it?
Just because, I mean, at least when I got into the College of Optics, the way that it was pitched is that optics isn't everything, and if it's not in something, you can add it and make it better. Which I remember at the time, I thought, well, that sounds great, but it's very ambiguous. And then when I went through the undergrad program, I had a very fixed view that optical engineering was essentially limited to imaging systems.
Okay. Yeah, everyone that goes into optics probably thinks imaging or some variation, the optical physics arena from there. Non-imaging, sure. That wasn't known about, but you see these type of systems everywhere. They're all above us, above our heads. They're on your phones.
Mm-hmm.
You take them for granted. I don't really think too much changed my thought. Really, the only thing that's come, and it's only come in the past few years, is that this is probably the century of optics or light. Electrons were the previous century. So most devices you see now, I think what you said is, Logan, is coming true, is that optics is making things better now, finally.
Right.
And we didn't have that luxury before. And it's because the technology wasn't advanced enough to do it. I kept learning. And so when I got into non-imaging optics, it just flowed into my head naturally that it was correct. I would say in my middle name for most of my students is Eitan Du. I didn't know that. And I've learned that.
Is it really?
Really?
It should be, is what my students say.
Okay.
But I learned that. So I would say that changed some mindset within me. And now I talk about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it just changed. It gave a word or a definition to what was causing difficulty in design.
Right. Okay.
So it was more learning the lingo, I guess, than anything changing per se.
There's a name to attach to what's.
Yes. And interesting, Eitan Du was only defined in the 70s.
Oh.
So. And it's because it was there, and a bunch of people commented in some applied optics papers, what should we call this?
Whoa.
So it's a more recent definition or of something that is inherent in the design process.
Huh, that's wild.
It was there. People knew about it.
Right.
But it had no name.
Right.
Okay.
And so my advisor during graduate school, he didn't know what it was.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And he was a brilliant man. He just not heard it explained. We had the book we used for radiometry had it defined in there because that book was from 78 or 82 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it was defined in there, but
yeah,
most people in optics didn't know what it was back then. So in that mindset, I would say, yes, that changed my perception. But it's really a large concept, but not overall a big thing.
Right. And I guess, I mean, that's kind of the process is that once something's discovered, everyone kind of takes for granted after that, you know, that that's just the way that things work. But prior, at the time of, it's usually pretty mind-blowing for everyone involved.
Yeah. So talking about the change of nowadays technologies, in your opinion, what is the changes in nowadays in illumination design?
The changes, there's more people practicing it. It's becoming much more efficient. It's just not put a light in somewhere and hope it works.
Yeah.
So it's getting much more efficient. The industry worldwide is probably one of the largest optics industries that most people, it's at least 500 billion, if not a trillion each year. So it's a huge industry.
Just for elimination?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, in the United States alone, just I can talk about all the light bulbs, and that's probably a $15 to $20 billion industry right there. Displays, and I call displays illumination devices because that's what they are, in my opinion. That's a $50-plus billion industry. A lot of the lithography techniques, they have a lot of illumination in them. And then you can even take it into the solar arena and the electrical production. Like Germany right now, I just read that they have a negative cost for electricity.
From their solar
deployment. Yeah. So that they actually have to pay their they're paying their populace because they have enough solar coming from the houses. They're paying them to use the surplus
electricity.
Because otherwise they don't know what to do with the electricity.
Right.
So,
and that's not, it's obvious, but that's not like Tucson. I mean, no. Germany is not Germany, as bright and sunny.
Germany should not be a renewable energy resource, except for maybe wind or something like that.
Right.
But they have predominantly solar there. So if Arizona did it, we would not be have any need for standard electrical production. So you can take it into all these industries and easily, in the United States, get it to 250 billion plus, and then if I put it around the whole world, I can easily get to 500 billion, and maybe even a trillion if I push it. Now I'm taking the whole device, so the whole display, the whole
phone. Everything put together.
So if you want to section it off from there, the only industry in optics that's probably bigger now, and that's telecommunications, and that's only happened in the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I think my girlfriend teaches middle schoolers, and I've spoken to them a couple times about optics. And it's always really easy because you can basically say, point to something, and I'll tell you how optics is in it, which is just kind of astonishing. But anyways, do you see the emphasis? You're the associate dean, so I think you have a really great grasp on where you see the future of academic optics going, particularly for this college. Can you comment on that?
Do you mean that on the research side or purely just the classroom?
I don't know. Can you comment? Yeah, I mean, can you comment to both?
Undergraduate, I think we're going to see more, or maybe I should say less and less of the standard lecture environment. Increasingly, I think professors are making more use of trying to engage the students more in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the distance learning type technologies, the ability that we can film, that will really help. And as new professors come in, we'll see that more and more because they will have seen it during their education.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then optics being so visual, it really behooves us to go in that direction.
Right.
On the research side, I think there's going to be more and more projects from industry, and we're going to see more of that coming in. And students are actively working in industry while getting their degrees. So I see more and more of this distance type education. I don't want to call it distance type education, but really education in the field at the same time.
Right.
And I think we're going to see that in the PhD and in the fields. The fields that we're looking at, I would say that there's this quantum engineering that's coming out, and that's sort of between the photonics and the optical physics. The telecommunications will always play a large role, and the biomedical area optics will just always be huge. And then in the optical engineering, I really think we're going to have more integration with the optomechanics and also designing worse systems and allowing the computer to process
compensate.
Yeah. And so that combines the imaging to the optical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the four fields we have here. And I don't think we'll move away from fundamental and applied technologies. That'll still be here. It's just more of the fundamental will start actually playing a larger role on the applied side. And a great example is what's being done with like the frequency cone laser now is being used in actual engineering. And that was, 5 years ago, just
right
in the science lab, not in the engineering side.
Right. I get the sense, at least here, and I'm curious to get your perspective, Zhang-Yu, but at least here I feel like the College of Optics, in a very healthy way, is guided and supported by the industry. There's a lot of feedback between the two, or at least for our group anyways. We work with industry people. And it does push the boundaries of what they might find useful.
Mm-hmm.
But in a couple more years, it becomes extremely useful. I don't know if that's similar in your experience previously.
Yeah, it's quite similar to my experience. Mm-hmm. So I'm focused on the optical manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So what I always get is from industry, they got new materials with new requirements on the surface, like how you're going to make it and fast and cheap.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's where it's moving to. So even with your large mirrors,
mm-hmm.
can we make that faster, better? Cheaper, faster, mm-hmm. better.
Right.
Always like that.
I will caution you, JPL started that, it was about 12 years ago. They said cheaper, faster, better. And then the mantra that came out was choose one and you get it, not the other two.
Right.
So there is always caution there.
Right.
Yeah,
that's certainly true.
One of the first systems I worked on was a satellite and was approaching Mars, and they were having a stray light problem on it.
Really?
And it's just because they hadn't done enough homework to see it.
It was having the problem while it was approaching Mars, not...
Yes, yeah, it was already millions of miles away.
Perfect. I guess going back to the academic side... are you fairly optimistic about optics as an academic, as getting people interested in it, I guess?
There is no problem once they become aware that optics is a field that can be studied. It's just half the battle. And every society, every university has had the problem of teaching people what optics is. So here we are at a university, 35,000 undergrads or something like that?
Something enormous, yeah.
And we have an undergraduate class each year, 40 plus right now. We could easily get more. And we're within the College of Engineering there too, so we're limited by what engineering is. And we could get more, but then there is the added benefit, and I put that in double quotes for you, of optics being a difficult field.
Right.
And if you were just doing one flavor, geometrical, physical, quantum, I don't think it would be too challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you have to learn all three, there comes the challenge. Maybe the undergraduates are really learning too and hearing about the quantum side.
Mm-hmm.
But learning both, it's really challenging. You have to learn a lot of lingo, a lot of new math, take a lot of courses, and sometimes you can get confused between the various disciplines. So, I don't know, we have to fight this perception, but it is the age of the photon rather than the age of the electron. Sure, the electron's still there, it makes our detectors work, it makes our lasers work, blah, blah, blah. But now light is becoming imperative in everyone's life. If we didn't have it, we wouldn't have the cell phone. Or the smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have the internet as we see it. So telling students that, it's one thing. I currently have a couple honor students and I'm trying to entice them to do optics. And they have to see that it's engaging and that there are careers. We can't graduate enough students.
Right.
So that's easy to say, for me to say, but they have to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And by I think coming over here, they can see how good this field is right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, if there's a downturn in the economy, all bets are off, but optics will return sooner rather than later.
People aren't going to stop using smartphones, so I think.
Yeah, actually, this is one big difference I see here from China. So go back in China because I finished my undergrad there. Mm-hmm. It's like most of the university would divide the optics into different field for students. So if you focus more in engineering, then you get really less knowledge background about the photonics or the quantum mechanics, something uh-huh. about that. And people who is focused on the photonics or optical physics or lasers, they get really limited knowledge on the geometry, mm-hmm. optics and all the things. At first, we thought it would be okay, but as time goes by, you generally realize it is actually an issue because it limits your point of view and also limits how you think of questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've seen that by taking the classes here. We mm-hmm. make you take you guys are more on the optical engineering side, so you have That's to take true. An optical physics class.
One.
Yeah.
And then the optical physicists have to take
geometrical
optics. Yeah. And, you know, I can almost look at the grades and tell who are the optical physicists yeah. and mm-hmm. who are the optical mm-hmm. engineers.
Yeah.
But that just comes with the territory. We want you to understand the three interpretations of light.
Right.
Yeah.
And be able then to work in any of the industries once you leave here. Because all of you are in high demand once you leave here.
Mm-hmm.
Might not be able to find exactly where you want to work, exactly where you want to live at the income or the job that you would be doing there. But right. you can find a position that will reward you.
There seems to be plenty of jobs, personally speaking. I will say that we spoke with, I don't think he'll mind, but we spoke with Chase Salisbury,
mm.
who's a graduate student, and we were talking about the fact that you, in graduate school, let alone this graduate school, or the College of Optics graduate program, you kind of are selecting for motivated people, but also people who are pretty smart. And I remember it was a very sobering moment taking electricity and magnetism, because my background was not in physics. And Masood definitely taught me how little I knew of that subject. Like, you take the first exam and you kind of stare at it and stare at it and stare at it. And then you go like, oh, okay, this is going to be my first failing grade in graduate school. But it is really important. I mean, once you learn it, it's like, whoa.
You had seen Maxwell's equations.
Yeah.
But not to the depth that Mr.
Right. You knew that Maxwell was a pretty smart guy, you know, but after Masood's class, it's like, wow. I mean, you just look at everything differently, which I thought it was pretty valuable in hindsight. At the time, I was like, wow, this is awful. I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be in grad school. But hindsight, yeah, it's definitely worth it. So, I guess speaking to that, how do you motivate students? I guess, again, academically and research-wise, that's two very
undergraduate,
separate issues.
It's different for an undergraduate. You have to keep them motivated. It's hard. And they have many more classes within a given semester
mm-hmm.
and many other things. And it's like the first time they've been away from home. The way to motivate them is there is light at the end of the tunnel. You will graduate. You will have a fairly good opportunities in industry or graduate school. Master's is just a continuation. Typically with the master's, they've already experienced it. They know they want the master's. The PhD, the classes are important, but not as important as most students think. There are some professors that think if you're getting A's in classes, you're spending too long on the class. You should be getting B's, not C's, of course.
Right in the middle, just
right
in the middle.
Because you should be in the left. But the PhD is doing that independent research, okay, and basically being your own boss while you still have a boss or a mentor. And then satisfying that mentor or boss with your results. You know, when I said you can get 3 or 4 months, you could probably have all of your work done if you didn't have to do all that learning at the same time. When you all get graduated, you'll look back and go, I could have done that in a short time. Okay? the master's thesis with maybe not 3 or 4 months, maybe 2 months.
Right.
You know, somewhere in that area, a month or 2 months. Projects and classes, a week. You know, in industry, that's what you're doing, a project in a class is a week-long project, essentially, where you're spending maybe the whole semester doing it. So how do you motivate them? With the PhD, a lot of that has to be self-motivation then. And then what we are downstairs is, I don't want to, maybe this isn't right, but we're your support or cheerleading squad in the academic programs. And that's really what your friends and peers should be. You can get this done. You can get out. And then we provide a few of those little carrots saying, well, your friends are getting nice jobs at this company and they're getting paid all this money. And you can do what you want after you get the PhD. That's really where the motivation should be. And no student should think once they graduate here that they have to stay in their field and they have to even stay in optics. We have graduates from here that have gone on to many other things. So you have shown the ability to lead your own effort, which is really what the PhD is teaching you. You're getting an expert in an area, so you can go out of here and run a company. Most PhD people don't do a great job at it because they treat it as a research project.
Right.
So you have to change your mindset, but you can do it.
Huh.
Wow, it's really different.
It is. That's good for me to hear personally. Yeah, I don't know. That's just, I guess being in it, the way that I look at it is, that the PhD is a lot of work to prove your dissertation.
Really what you're getting at is the ability to carry on independent research basically from the beginning to the end without all the hand-holding.
Right, right.
That you need to be able to do that yourself. It is your project. Now, sure, there is this mentor looking over your shoulder and steering you to where he or she would like to go, or what the project is saying you're going to get done. But you are learning during that how to carry on that work, and that is so important. And that's where students struggle, that you have to be very self-motivated. So how do we keep that motivation going? If you're having problems, you come down and talk to us in the academic office. You talk to your advisor. You talk to your friends. I always say, you should be doing for your PhD something that excites you.
Right.
So where I said, I'm not doing lasers, they don't excite me anymore.
Right.
And that's what was making it hard during that. I did 2 years on ultra short pulse characterization because we had funding for that. That's when I learned it didn't excite me because I said I got my postdoc before I got my PhD because there's 2 years that are not in my dissertation. And I have a paper or two on it, and I never did any more on it.
I think that is tricky, part of that. I think I was talking with you and Neil maybe that when you get into grad school, you choose a lab and you start doing research, and to an extent, you kind of hope that you end up liking that research. Hopefully you have more knowledge before you decide to embark on this, but I think a lot of students that I've encountered discover along the way, like, ooh, this isn't
what I want.
Yeah, or the project that's being funded isn't.
Every year I'm noticing the students that are applying are more and more doing research. And that might be because they're learning more about optics before they come here.
Right.
Now, you got your undergrad here, but you were over in China and you were doing optics over there. But you were saying, if you were doing one flavor, they kept you in that flavor.
That's true. It's always the thing in China.
Yeah. So, and you really just saw the optical engineering side. And
I did biomedical optics.
Okay,
a lot of biomedical, yeah.
Okay. That, so you learn some of that material, and then, like, our students really don't know much about quantum optics when they come here. There's a few that do because they take a few more physics classes. But you really, most students, when they come here, they don't have enough knowledge to really choose what they would do. And so it takes maybe a year or two. Some it takes a few years longer. Some know exactly what they want to do. We've had optical physicists coming in here and they start working on mirror technology. We've had optical optical engineers come in and switch over to optical physics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just maybe takes you a little longer because you have to learn a little more material.
Right.
So that's what we're trying to provide so that you can study what you want. But then, yes, there's always the problem that your advisor has money for a project.
Mm-hmm.
And your dissertation is usually something very well aligned with that project. Doesn't
right.
need to be, but there's very few people that have the funding or their own money to study exactly what they want.
Right. I think I've changed my tune a little bit too. It might be a little bit harsh, but I basically think like that's just a reality of the world. You know, like,
it'd be nice to get to that other one where you could actually study.
Yeah,
maybe to what the was back in the 1600s through the 1800s, where you had a mentor and you worked with that mentor.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
For the most part.
Yeah.
So talking about the undergrad and grad students. If there are somebody who is not so sure, or they want to go to the grad school, but they do not have a clear view about it, what would you talk to them like?
If they know they want to go to grads or want to get a graduate degree, and they don't know if master's or PhD, I tell them to go PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So then you only have to apply once, because you can always go from the PhD down. You can't go the other way without reapplying. If they don't know, I always encourage them to do what their heart tells them to do. Okay, and right now, money is a big drug thing. Some of our best students after undergraduate or master's are going to industry because they can make a wealth of money. And I'll tell you, if you do the analysis, if you get your master's degree, you will earn more over your lifetime than the PhD graduate. You won't have as much independence, probably.
You should have told me this a couple of years ago.
So I think a recent class, most of the students, undergraduate, had figured that out. So most
right.
of them are getting their master's rather than PhD. However, the PhD gives you so much more independence. I also tell them if you go out and start working, it's very hard to return.
Yep.
Because you will start getting,
yeah.
you guys have lives, but they're going really into their career.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to change your career. They're more likely to get married, start a family, move to somewhere where they want to keep living, buy a house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a student, you see everything is temporary still. So I tell them to follow their heart. But then ultimately, I want all the best students to come here. So if there are really good students that aren't coming, I'll really strongly encourage. But usually I have found those best students, they know what they want to do. So.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tell them, well, we're here for the distance master's, or you can come back for your PhD. But that is very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they know they're going to do the distance master's. It's very rare to return for the PhD.
And is that the biggest distinction, or at least a key distinction that you see? And the way that I view master's is that you kind of distinguish your capabilities for industry. And I see the PhD program, not only you're extremely skilled in one special topic, but that you're going to be more of an independent type of worker when you get done.
The master's I see as a professional degree,
mm-hmm.
like if you're going to law or business,
right.
that you're becoming better at the field. And you can lead projects, but you might not lead in the conceptual design
mm-hmm.
of that project. You're more there to get it done. The PhD will be more, they will also come in and be the lead, but often they'll be the ones developing new technology
mm-hmm.
that then the team can take over with that person then being, the PhD being the scientist on the project.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true. It depends on which industries. The smaller the companies, you're going to wear many hats. The larger the company, you're going to typically be that
right.
conceptual developer. For a master's that goes out and works at a company, they can rise up to that, but they have to prove it by working there. So if by the time you get a PhD and one of your peers got his master, he or she got his master's and went out, by the time you come out, you might both be being considered for that position. However, that person in the master's at that time is so much more integral into the company's future. And then they will be considered for other things, leading a division or something. So, and then the PhD maybe doesn't want to get into all that red tape stuff.
Right.
Good point.
Do you have any advice for, because we talked to a lot of graduate students, and invariably you're going to go through some period where grad school is challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any advice for graduate students that are in that position?
If it's gotten so extreme, take a leave of absence.
Huh.
Okay.
I didn't expect that one.
No, if it's getting to the point where you're considering dropping out.
Right.
Take a leave of absence and go and work in industry or something for a year or a half year. And you might go, oh, this is terrible, or I love this. Do what you enjoy. If, you know, coming into work as a PhD is just a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone experiences, as you said, I had it too. And there are students that probably come in and they get nothing done during the day. At that point, you need a break. And if you stay here, you're not going to get much work done. Mm-hmm. You're going to be unhappy with your life. And you hear from all your friends who are out working and they're enjoying their lives. So go and see if you want that. And then see if you want your PhD. Take a leave of absence. It's always a good idea. If you're not at the extreme, I said extreme, okay? If you're at the point where it might be just daily or weekly perturbation in there, that's when you can come talk to your friends, talk to us downstairs, and try to work through it. Then there are the times where someone just can't get along with their advisor.
Yeah.
And even if you're in your fifth year, I tell the student, you have to do what makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you're working on a project or that just does not excite you, you better move.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so we have those every year. I shouldn't say every year. We have those from time to time. And even if you're in your third, fourth, fifth year, and you know you want your PhD and everything's gone smoothly, but the project does not engage you, you need to make that transition. And if it's the program here, you know, you can always see if you can go to a different program. But we want you to finish your PhD here, and we'll do everything we can to get you through it. So, and don't move groups lightly, okay? Just don't make it seem like it's like you're just annoyed with something. Make sure you've thought of everything, because that could burn a bridge. And you have to make sure that it's the project or whatever is not engaging you, and it's just not something else.
Yeah, I think we talked to Chase, we've talked to other people, but I personally kind of feel like there's a limited amount of resources for undergraduates in the sense of just kind of the reality that you are going to run into things outside of your control that'll be challenging in grad school. Like, you are going to have papers rejected, you are going to have to work on projects that you might not find the most exciting. I'm not even talking about projects where it's like, wow, this doesn't interest me, I should move on, but just kind of, there'll be times when it's like, man, this is tedious, mm-hmm. etc. And I don't know of any easy way to provide resources to make undergraduates or people interested in grad school more aware of that reality. But I think a lot of people encounter it and kind of, that can be a temporary stumbling block of saying like, ooh, this is what I'm in and this is actually what it's like. But the talking to friends or whatever is getting more perspective, getting more people to tell you, yeah, you're not the only one going through this is pretty
every
valuable.
Student almost goes through it. There's probably a few here and there.
So slide on by, somehow dodge it.
They just get on the perfect project that excites them. Everything works. And ultimately, I can tell you why lasers don't excite me. They break. And that just didn't excite me ever. Even when I was developing lasers, like, oh, the diode laser failed.
It's fun. I'm taking the photonics communication lab right now, just because I'm here and I can. This is something really useful I learned from Daewook and Jim Birch when he was here, was like, where else are you going to be able to do this, you know, when you're not in graduate school, much less this is graduate school, I guess. But man, I really do not like working with fiber lasers. Like, I really don't.
Like coupling into them?
Yeah, and getting all this and doing all this tedious work, mm-hmm. and at the end it's not that great. I really like working on big optics, you know? Yeah.
Like, give you something, like, feel stable and, like, you're really doing something.
Yeah, you know, I know what's going on with this. The fiber lives the fiber half the time, and it's like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, but what if you put, like, an a signal coming down the fiber, like a TV show, and then you saw it at the end? Then you're excited.
Certainly, yeah, definitely. I just mean...
I know,
Sure. I mean, I'm excited with what other people can do with fibers. I'm not personally excited with working with.
I agree.
But I think that's a really important part. You know, mm-hmm. I think that I just think it's tough. I think it is really easy to start and say, like, wow, I think fibers are cool. And then to get working with them or with whatever and say, they are cool, but it's not what I want to be working with.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully people are listening. Keep that in mind. Like you said, if you don't find it interesting, move to something you do find interesting.
Graduate studies with your thesis or dissertation should be a passion.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Not just a job.
Right, right.
So that is the biggest difference, I guess, between working and...
Yeah.
At a company to doing your education, graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And coming to that realization is one of the hardest challenges. It should not feel like a chore. And classes at the beginning probably make you start thinking that graduate school is a chore.
Right. Yeah, I can agree with that.
And that mindset might not disappear. And then when you get in the lab and things aren't working, it starts to become a chore again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then your friend down the hallway, everything's going swimmingly with them, and you get jealous and... everything, but then sooner or later something will go wrong in theirs.
Right, right.
And yours will be better.
Right. That back and forth, though. Yeah.
And failure does not mean... failure on an experiment does not mean failure on research.
So yeah.
That's hard to teach, but there's so much learning going on that.
We have only 10 more minutes, so I'd like to get back to illumination. But I do want to say very briefly... something I'm interested in seeing how it develops, or if you've seen it develop, is that, again, to go back to my girlfriend who's a teacher, she's noticed that there's an increasing emphasis on you either perform or you don't perform in middle school or high school or whatever, in the sense of exams. And kids either get this mentality of you either are good or you're not good. And if you fail, then it's like, you're out, you're not good. And I just can't imagine a worse mentality. I can imagine a few worse mentalities, but that has to be a pretty bad mentality if you're going towards something like graduate school, because failure is just part of the game. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's hopefully something you can turn into a learning experience. I don't know if you've witnessed that at all, or if you will in the future.
With the graduate school, we're here to make sure you get your PhD or your master's. You will succeed, but if you don't want it, we're here to help you get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still that metric, you know, that now we have the qualifying exam and then there's the comprehensive exams. You have to pass both of those. And probably the hurdle now is with the new qualifying exam here. And yes, you can fail that, you can retake it, and then if you fail that, then the graduate college says, or we say, you're excused from the program. We can help you beyond that to potentially continue with the PhD, or you can go down to the master's. That's not going to change. So there is still that fail, succeed type thing. And what you were talking about with the education, you know, you're really getting into all of this, No Child Left Behind, and it actually does leave children behind. that the failures in our educational system are coming at the earliest levels.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think it's fine in the elementary, but as you go into middle school, it starts to get more of that attitude. But once you get in here, undergraduate, graduate, we'll do everything to make sure you succeed. Okay? Maybe that won't be, you know, at the highest level, but as you get out of here, there are plenty of people that still need you because the top and our lowest students here can do most of the jobs that are out in industry. Now, can they get into the best PhD programs? That's hard.
Right.
Okay? Because they're looking for that ability to carry on independent research, and not everyone can do that. And that's where the struggle comes. Can you conduct that independent research and get through all the exams, all the hardship along the way? I would say it's not fail or succeed at one moment. I would say graduate school is an arduous journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take a long time for you really to not succeed in the thing. It's a lot of work to get there. I can recall back to my graduate school having weekly assignments, and basically you would just go until you finished all the assignments. Then it was time to have a little fun, and then it was time to start over for the next week.
Mm-hmm.
Just kept that going. And then when you got into the research, it was just continuous work with a bunch of things that happened along the way. So that mindset you're saying with it's coming out of the primary educational system, I think that's setting back a lot of people that would succeed.
Yeah.
I think most of the people that are getting on to graduate school, they're the ones that were able to meet that challenge. And so I think most of the people in graduate school, they've been challenged, and they're the ones that succeeded all the time. I would like to see more going to graduate school, though.
Right. I just, not to harp on, but I mean, you'll like physically see kids who will get not an A in the primary system, and they'll like bang their heads against a desk or something because they're so frustrated. And man, I'd be brain dead if I did that at this point. But.
Yeah. But overall, both of you probably did really well.
Yeah, but
anyways. And the challenge is much harder for women, mm-hmm. especially in the sciences, because especially, I don't know about China, but in the United States, there's documented evidence of women not being encouraged to pursue the STEM areas. And you can just see it in videotapes at the primary level.
Yeah.
And so they're not rewarded for wanting.
Right.
Women
right.
are not as rewarded. And it's our goal to get more women in here, but it's too late in the process. We have to work with primary education. Mm-hmm. And that's why we try to do some outreach, but it needs to be more of a global effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we should interview you again and talk more
about
the primary.
That's true.
primary outreach efforts. But before we do finish, I would really like to hear what your perspective is on going forward in optics. What do you think is going to be the hot topics in illumination specifically, and maybe optics more generally?
Well, I said quantum information. In illumination, the holy grails right now are for non-invasive measurements on the human body.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best is glucose monitoring for diabetes, and they're often trying to look at the skin. There have been, I don't know, 20, 50 companies that have started and failed, and they've used all kinds of illumination techniques, looking at the skin, looking at the eye. So that's a holy grail. A previous one was solid-state lighting on automobiles for forward lighting. That's now been done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's no longer. They just needed better LEDs. So they've done it. I would say in illumination also, I think most of the developments are going to come out of materials. Like solar is a pretty moribund industry right now. And I think they're just lacking the materials. Mm-hmm. So I think the illumination is there. So once again, I guess what I'm saying is we needed better LEDs, we needed better materials. We're often needing better devices in illumination.
Right.
And those are the things holding back. Then also on the illumination and the design side, So I talked about étendu, but now the forefront is designing around skewness, which is the first derivative of étendu. And so design, and this takes us into freeform optics. So being able to design those systems so that they work effectively and that they're also tolerant to any fabrication errors. You guys are working, are you both working on the large mirrors to some extent?
Yeah.
Okay. So those are made, what, over years?
Yeah.
Years. So the illumination optics are made in seconds. Okay. So their tolerances are much looser. So you'll make the tooling technology, which will take months, but then they do things with injection molded plastics, and that takes seconds to fabricate them. And so they come out, and they have to be very tolerant to source position errors, fabrication errors on the optics. And so I'd see that's a forefront in the illumination field, how to make the optics more tolerant. And that's what one of the things that was limiting forward lighting on automobiles. So until they made brighter LEDs, it wasn't possible because you just didn't have enough photons to do what you required. Once they made a brighter LED, it still meets the demands of
right.
the illumination with not as efficient as it could be.
Huh.
Good. I think that's all for today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As always, thank you for listening to this week's episode. We look forward to any comments or feedback you may have. To leave a comment, please visit our website at loft.optics.arizona.edu/podcast or our Facebook, which is SPL Report. Additionally, you can email us at thespotlightreport@gmail.com. Lastly, we would like to mention that we are always looking for new topics or people to interview. So if you have a topic that you would like us to cover, please let us know. Thank you and have a good week.